Accession number 31699, reel 4.
With the vehicles all mixed up there, over the, can you imagine? Anyway, I had to go into this American camp, and I saw the CEO, and I said, "Have you got any parts for so and so engine?" "Oh no," he said, in southern drawl. But he said, "I've got the engine. If you you can have the engine if you like." I thought, well, I better go back and see the CEO about this. The chap in charge of the workshops. And he said, no. He said, don't take the engine. For some reason, don't take it. And we had to work our problem out the best we could. Then we had lawyers delivered to them. Our lawyers delivered to the Yanks, and they assembled them all and towed them in six at a time. He said, "We've assembled your lawyers for you." And I said, "Thank you very much." Looked at them. "Well, godfathers, I wouldn't have seen, I'd have been dead, I think, if I'd taken them out. They'd take them all to pieces and build them up properly." Yes. That was all good fun, if you like that sort of thing. And we used to get one day off in 10 days, because we were working quite long hours. And if the Italian campaign was about, I don't know whether it had started or it was about to start, and they wanted 3-ton lorries, a lot of them, and I got pulled out of the nephew one. I went to the flight sergeant, Underdale workshops, and I had to assemble with others. We worked, I think, to about 10 o'clock at night, and assembling vehicles. That we also assembled not only Chevrolets, we did a lot of Ford, Dodges. Oh yes, that reminded me. We used to have competitions between ourselves to see how quickly we could assemble a vehicle. And with body, of course. And there were two of us. And we started off with a packing case. Enormous, great packing case, and you had your crowbar thing to sort of lid, prise off the lid and the sides. And we assembled this, we unpacked the vehicle, assembled it on the base of the packing case. We built the vehicle, put the back on. And we did this in one day and drove it off the packing case. Nobody else did it in a day. Two of us did. We were very pleased about that. It gave you something to think about. So, record. Guinness Book of Records, perhaps? Never know. And then In our spare time, we went down to Algiers, and we spent quite a bit of time in the Malcolm Club. Who Malcolm was, I don't know, but I think it was a benefactor who supplied enough money for a. It was, I suppose it must have been like a shop, it had been taken over. And there were rows of tables like the old Lance Corner House, where you could get drinks and refreshments and beer and all sorts of other things and something to eat. And there were no glasses. We used to drink out of half beer bottles. And there was a way of cutting a beer bottle in half. I don't know whether you put oil in it to start with and pour on hot water, and then it cracks round It's one or the other. Either you put the water in first or you oil in. But after a second, I just don't know. But there were no glasses. It was just drinking out of half beer bottles. And my friend, we used to meet in there and say, you know, where we were working, see you down the Malcolm Club. And of course, one chap was missing out of the group that I was in. And he said, I'll poke my head outside and see if I can see him coming up the road. Poked his head outside, walked in the arms of an SP, you know, military police, who clobbered him for having his top button undone. He was cross about that. Yeah, and he went out to see if our friend was coming, and he got done for it, improperly dressed.
What were you wearing at this stage?
I was wearing, at the stage, the ordinary uniform. Or was I? No, it must have been... I think I must have been in Cady, because I've got a photograph taken in Algiers, in Cady.
The khaki?
Khaki drill. I don't know. I think it must have been... I just can't recall.
How did you find working in the North African climate?
It was all right. But I didn't take much notice of it, really. I think probably during the winter time we must have been, it was like the wet season, you know. We must have been in a ordinary uniform, I think. And then and boiler suits over. In the summer we were probably changing the KD. I can't help it on that.
Were there any? Did the climate lead to any issues with the health or?
No. I was one of the lucky ones. Escaped. I just had one. I had a dose of the sopranos, if you like, while I was out there, and spent one night in hospital, where everybody else. If something went through the camp. It was dreadful, it really was. Hospital was full of it. But I was reasonably all right, so I left the following day.
How were you treated?
Well, in the hospital.
Medically?
Yeah, fine. But I remember I had toothache. I can't remember whether it was in Aden or whether it was in North Africa. And I went round to see the dental officer. He had to do some drilling. And believe it or not, he had a treadle machine. You know what the old Singer sewing machine's like. And he had this, and he was pedalling away like mad and drilling my teeth out. Well. It did the job all right. But I think it might have been Aden, because I don't think in Algiers they were that backward. I can still see this human thing. I thought, my godfathers, pedaling away with one foot and doing your teeth with the other. I don't know how he did it.
How much contact did you have with your parents during this time?
I used to write to them once a week, and they used to write to me once a week, and all the letters were, some went out there. I've got them all the letters that I've sent home, one-way traffic if you like, all upstairs. My mother saved the whole lot, and they're all in the bundles upstairs. Most of them are airmail letters. But there were others at times, and with aerograph, you know, the ones you wrote on the aerograph, the form, and they shrink it down to about that size. And it was a little envelope. Some of those were, some of them were upstairs as well. But I don't think I ever had anything censored. Well, so what they used to do is either they used to blot it out, what it was saying, and the censor didn't like it or something. But generally speaking, you could you could hold it up to the light and see what was underneath. And then again, a lot of them used to cut it out, the letters. And you get your letter and there's a piece cut out of it. But, yeah. Everything forms a pattern. Well, I must tell you about one thing. The packing cases that we used to get with the lorries in. On the side of the packing case was a piece of cardboard, a piece of plywood of about 18 inches by a foot, nailed on the side with details of weight and all the rest of it. Inside would be the packing details, sandwiched between the packing case and the piece of plywood. Now, if you were sending anything home, you wanted a piece of plywood, didn't you? There was a mad scramble to prise this off the side of the packing cases as they came in. I managed to get two, and you'd take them down to the carpenter, who would make you a box, depending on you know what you're sending home. I think we were limited to a certain weight, but I sent half a dozen oranges home. They were green. Put them in, you know, I worked out size and took it down to the carpenter, and he made the box with my piece of plywood, a couple of pieces of plywood, and packed the oranges in, paid the postage, and they went out. And nothing was ever lost. The oranges arrived and they were red and they were orange when they got home. Unbelievable now, because I mean, in those days you couldn't get oranges or anything. They were luxury. And I sent a handbag home, and for my mother, I had some shoes made in Aden, and there, you lot are, you know, the World Museum is interested in those. At any rate, what happened after that?
How closely were you able to follow the progress of the war then while you were in North
Carolina? Yes, we had a newspaper. I've got a copy of it somewhere. Copies of it. I've kept it. Air Force Times or something it was called. And that gave you progress on what was happening. Things like magazines were sent out to you, but you couldn't buy anything like that. You got your ration of cigarettes, which I didn't smoke, I traded them in for chocolate. You could amass quite a stack of chocolate, and then I had a cupboard made by the, I think they were Italians. I worked a lot with Italians and Yugoslavs. They were prisoners of war, you know. They're very nice blokes too, and they were very, very clever, especially the Italians. And they made me a cupboard with a lock on it, so nobody could nick anything, you know. And I can remember one day being shown a cigarette case, which was made out of aluminium. I don't know where the aluminium came from, don't ask. It was, my imagination says it was about that size, a cigarette case. And it was beautifully engraved. One of the Italians did it, you know, they have a bit on the artistic, and he chiseled out the inside, and he did all the chasing work on the outside. It was absolutely beautiful, and that cost the bloke a tin of cigarettes. Just one of those free tins of cigarettes, which the Italian must have been a heavy smoker or something, and that was all he charged. Yeah. You could do a lot of trading with chocolate and cigarettes. But, they were always clamouring after the cigarettes because some of them chain smoked almost. But the Italians were very, 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 very good. And the Yugoslavs.
Cool. What was their morale like?
Good. I mean, you could basically say they lived in a, you know, similar to us, very similar to the English people.
Were there any German prisoners?
No Germans.
What was the morale like among your own?
Well,
our own camp.
Well, we just accepted it and went about our daily work, and there's no problems at all. Except, I did a risky thing one day. We were doing very heavy work on diesel engines, if I remember rightly. And everybody was complaining they didn't get enough breakfast. We knew what was happening. A lot of the food was going out the back door. So, I think I was NCO at the time. So I said, this is not good enough. So I marched them round to the CO's office. And I went in there, banged on his door, and went in. Dangerous thing to do, but I did. I said, we've got a problem. I said, we're not getting enough to eat, we're doing heavy work, and we need the food. Can you help us? And he did. Lasted about 5 days, that's all. And we're back to square one again. But he was very good about it. That's all my point. At least we got, it wasn't a meagre meal, like on the transit camps. But we had quite a good meal, breakfast after that. You can't do this heavy work if you're not eating well. That's the thing.
What were your rations like as a?
Oh, they're quite good. Yes. Quite good. Can't remember a lot about them, but they were more than, I would say, more than adequate.
Was there much variation in what you were fed?
Yes. Oh, yes. It's the usual, you know, potatoes and greens and... Yeah. Yes. It kept you going, but it was good. Good basic food.
What was your experience in general of the officers and the chain of command?
Oh, very good. Very good. You see, we were like engineering staff, tradesmen, and we were really treated better than the ordinary airmen, if you like, because we were grade two, one and two. I can remember on one occasion, I think it was a Saturday afternoon, we were all lying on our beds, recovering from the week, you know, and a large centipede went right across the floor. God, you never see the bullet move so fast. A kit chucked out from under the beds and all the rest of them. A centipede's about that length. Not our tiddly things you get over here. and you get scorpions. We never found it. That's where it disappeared to, we don't know. That woke us all up very, very quickly.
Were there any issues with mosquitoes? Or?
Yes.
Yes. I think we had mosquitoes in Algiers. I know we had them in Aden. But I remember one of our chaps, he drove a lot, he was a lorry driver, forwarded lorry driver, and he drove a Bedford QL lorry, and he treated it like his own car. It was immaculate outside. He was always parked outside the building, never on the pound or anything. He always used to bring it home and lift it outside the building. And one day I had to go out with him. And inside, he would not believe it. It was absolutely sparkling, you know. you mustn't put muddy feet in it or anything like that. Absolutely perfection. You treat the lorry like his own car. it always made us smile. But what else did we have? No, that's about it, I think. Yes, there is another thing. The lighting system in North Africa, or on the camp at Mason Blanche. I don't know, 110 volts, I think, something like that. It wasn't our usual 230. And we had an electrician in the billet. And he lived quite luxuriously in the billet. He had a corner bed, and he built himself a nice table to put his stuff on and by the bed, so that he didn't have to get up, you know, all the rest of it. He said one day, or worse with the effect, sod this, and he said, I'm getting a bit fed up. He said, I can't, the light's so bad, he said, I can't read. And it was like reading by candlelight. They're all the same. And so he said, I'll sort this. And I went out one day, and I came back into the camp, because we're in Nissen huts, and there was our billet there, like Blackpool illuminations. Everybody else was down the candlelight, you know. You couldn't see anything in the other billets at all, in the other huts. We'd taken all the current. I think you've got nails in the fuse box or something. And, mind you, that only lasted 2 days. Had to get it all back to normal again. That's while it lasted. That's another thing I remember. And, of course, strange how these things come back to you when you're talking like this. The letter home. He used to write my letter on a certain day. Everything fell into a pattern. And I used to have to walk through the camp to the main building to post the letter. And there was always Glenn Miller playing. And every time I hear a certain tune played by Glenn Miller, it reminds me of Mason Blanche. And it's unbelievable, really. Even to this day, I hear a certain tune, and I think of Mason Blanche and post him in letter. Peculiar.
Was any sort of provision made for recreation or entertainment?
Yes, we used to get entertainment very infrequently. Well, they used to put up a stage in the main building. And so I suppose it would be. And so used to come down and give us a show. I always got a free ticket to it. You had to pay for it. I always got a free ticket. I used to look after the generator. The generator all account for the show. So that's, I was on standby with an electrician. I did the engine, he did the electrical work. And in case everything went out, and we got free tickets for it. But yes, there was another occasion where, or occasions if you like, Reveille in the morning, you assume Reveille is a bugle being played, don't you? It was, in a way, it was Harry James, you know, on his trumpet, coming over the tannoy at 6 o'clock in the morning. Can you imagine it? And one of my chums, he said, I'm fed up with this. He said, every morning Harry James playing his trumpet or waking us up. He said, I'm not having any more of this. He went out with a pair of pliers and cut the wires. So, I don't know what happened after that. But, well, I think that's about it. I can't remember anything else. Let me think now. We used to travel down to the from Mason Blanche camp to where we assemble the vehicles. We used to travel down by lorry. We had a fleet of lorries, and this used to take the troops down to where they worked. And one of them was a. It was a Fiat. No, Alfa Romeo, I'm wrong. It's Alfa Romeo, big heavy lorry, of course, was it? It came out of the scrapyard. There was an enormous scrapyard in there, in North Africa. And the only thing it wanted was a cylinder gasket and a fuel pump. And I had a look at this and I said to the sergeant, I said, I think we can get this going. All right, he said, yeah, we'll see if it can turn up. So I worked it out. A small fuel pump. I found one from somewhere. I don't know where I got it from, but anyway. I thought, well, that's about the size for the cylinders. I thought, well, that's about the size for the cylinders, and that fixed it all up by devious means. And it was all right, it worked all right, but it's a smoke. It didn't burn the fuel properly. I remember we always departed in the morning, great cloud of diesel fumes going up, but it worked all right.
How long were you stationed at Mason Blanche for?
I suppose it must be about a year or something. As I spent a long time on transit, a fair amount of time out Mason Carey, and in Algiers, I suppose I spent about 2.5 years. That's the thing. Around the year, 18 months perhaps. And
what happened next?
After I left Algiers, I was posted back to this country. I came back on the Dakota, flew back. Let me find the place here.